The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, September 15th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening today. Some big conversations on data this hour. Little bits of information from all over our universe. When you mix them together in the right way, can they make the grinding gears of bureaucracy lurch a little less slowly? We'll talk to the U.S. Chief Technology Officer on the future of what she calls digital governance. Now, data can also help solve crimes. Police are collecting more and more DNA from the people in their own communities. But are they going beyond the traditional fingerprint and collecting data in a way that undermines civil liberties? We'll talk about the criminal justice system in Chicago as a big gang trial gets underway. And Detroit thinks big as it tries to emerge from bankruptcy. But first, the climate is changing, and the U.S. military is on the front lines. Former military leaders, top brass, are increasingly sounding the alert that climate change is a direct national security threat to the United States. The clearest threat? Naval installations, other facilities on the water's edge, including the naval base at Norfolk, Virginia, the world's largest, at risk of being underwater as sea levels rise over the next 100 years. And that's just the beginning. Climate change is changing the planet, and that means it's changing the threats that we're going to ask the military to deal with. Can the military help us innovate our way out of this problem, or do we just need them to help sound the alert to politicians that climate change is a real threat? Retired Navy Admiral David Titley is an expert in the field of climate, the Arctic, and national security. He's professor in the Department of Meteorology and Atmospheric Science at Penn State. Admiral, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Also with us to talk about an energy initiative that could be operational moving forward in the military, Sharon Burke. She's senior advisor for the International Security Program and Resource Security at New America in D.C. Sharon, welcome.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Admiral, what does it mean to frame climate change as a national security threat? Is this the only way that we can get the political system to pay real attention? And I ask it in this way because Colin Powell is famous for helping motivate President George W. Bush to enact a major push on international AIDS by framing AIDS as a national security threat.
It's not really for me to say whether this will or will not motivate the political dialogue. So I would really just stick to this as a military issue. And as a retired senior military officer, I think it's really incumbent to lay out in plain language some of the challenges and even threats to U.S. Security writ large that we have going forward. So the climate is what I would call actually a risk more than a threat. If I think of the threat, I think of like back in the with the Soviets in the 70s and the 80s, and you know they had their finger on the nuclear button, and you know we tried to understand not only their military capabilities but their intentions. The climate is a little different. It doesn't have intentions. It's just physics. The ice doesn't care who wins this next election. The ice doesn't care who controls Congress. The ice just melts. So it's really this risk. And with the ice increasingly melting, the seas are going to rise. Ultimately, they're going to rise several feet, many feet. And we are going to have to deal with this. So climate as a security risk really comes down to the number of jobs and the number of unstable security situations are likely to increase in already unstable parts of the world. And at the same time, the climate is going to put both financial and military and readiness pressure on our U.S. forces as we train them to be ready at home. So it's both a home threat and an away threat.
So Sharon Burke, Admiral Titley is talking about two levels of risk and threat directly to a naval installation like Norfolk, and there are dozens like it, where sea levels rise, you can't use the port anymore. It's expensive. You have to move it inland or retool it to deal with the problem. But then the larger threat overseas, where drought, flooding causes instability, we're going to ask the military to intervene in those places.
That is true. And I think it's not just coastal installations. We also have a lot of military bases that are in arid areas. So there are going to be adjustments that have to be made in many, many places. So we have to take that into consideration. But the big challenge here is what the Pentagon in its core strategy documents has called an instability accelerant, that climate change affects underlying problems. So if you have weak governance, if you have a history of conflict, if you have poor access to water, to energy, the things that actually build human security, then you're at risk for hard security, for an actual conflict situation. And climate change can come in as an instability accelerator and make those things blow apart into actual conflict. And that's where the Pentagon needs to anticipate where these new factors might create new problems.
So Todd, maybe some of your listeners remember the old BASF commercial, they don't make things, they make things better. I would say right. With climate and security, climate doesn't make the situation, but it makes bad situations worse.
And in ways that aren't all that predictable at this time, because these weather effects that you're going to see from a shifting climate aren't necessarily knowable, but particularly how they affect life on the ground. So those are the things that I think now the Pentagon needs to turn to and have a demand signal for the kind of information they need to be able to plan for the future.
But Sharon, we've heard time after time, and I cover Congress and I spend plenty of time there, where orders to the Pentagon written into legislation require the military to not deal on some levels with climate change, to not bake it into their policy plans, and to not spend money on it.
I think that's terribly unfortunate. It happens every year in the defense authorization debates that there'll be a member that will stand up and make those kinds of proclamations. This should not be a partisan issue, because when you get right down to it, in this country, in every district in this country, people are recognizing that things are changing. So this is a reality for Americans and people all over the world.
Admiral Titley, what's the most proximal risk or threat from your perspective, let's say at naval installations all around the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast, for instance? Is it to build seawalls and protect those installations, or is it to find ways to move them inland as sea levels rise? If you were briefing a bunch of planners and a bunch of people who were going to spend the money on climate change over the next 50 years, what would you tell them?
The part that you really have to do first is as you look at these issues, is you find that they don't scale particularly well. That's kind of a strange way of saying every place, it's kind of like the old Tip O'Neill thing, every place is local and every place is a little different. They're different culturally, but they're also different physically. So like a levee may make a lot of sense in some places, but if you build like a really big levee in South Florida, turns out you're building it on limestone. So the water kind of laughs at you and just goes under the levee. So you need to understand the local conditions writ large. And that means, as I said, culturally, you need to understand the community. It's really important to think much broader than the base. Many people understand that while we have these marvelous bases like Norfolk Naval Base, but the people live in the community. The services like power, sewer, water, all come from and go back into the community. So, you know, you could build, let's say, a 9-foot wall, you know, at great cost, but you could build a 9-foot wall around the Norfolk Naval Base and keep it dry, and that's great. But if you don't have a workforce, either military or civilian, it hasn't really done you a whole lot of good. And in the military, yes, we look at most likely threats, but we also look at the most dangerous threats. So we could hope that in 50 years we're only talking about, let's say, a 0.5 foot to a foot, maybe a little more of sea level rise. But there are some credible studies that, especially for Norfolk, where you have a lot of things coming into play in addition to the global sea level rise, you probably, as a worst case, would be looking at like almost 3 feet. And then it's not only the average every day you wake up, it's a nice sunny day and the sea's 3 feet higher, but you got to think about then when a hurricane, even when a big nor'easter storm comes through, what does that mean? Some of that analytical work has actually already been done. The Army Corps of Engineers have done some nice studies on this, but now it's the hard part. Now it's the time where you have to start making those tough decisions. My expectation is it will be a combination of what we would call soft infrastructure, let's say natural protections, marshes that kind of dampen some of the storm surge. There will no doubt be some hard infrastructure, seawalls, levees, things like that. But at some point, there may be places that we just simply cannot afford to to keep anymore, and you start having to relocate. Those are very, very hard decisions.
Well, Sharon Burke, this talk of building seawalls means that there are some huge walls that the next president may in fact have to build. And I can't get around the idea that one of the presidential candidates has said that climate change is a hoax invented by the Chinese to destroy our economy. Now, as we're talking about this problem, and we have the potential for a president who sees it almost 180 degrees opposite, what does that say to you about the work that needs to be done here?
I mean, obviously, it makes the work more challenging. But at the same time, one of the things that we have seen, because the federal politics are complicated and not very conducive to progress, is that at the state and local level, there's been a lot of progress in dealing with climate change in all aspects. I was just down in Orlando, Florida, talking to some local officials there. And so, for example, they're doing a lot to cut their greenhouse gas emissions to do that, but also because it's good for their town. It makes their town more livable, makes their town more sustainable. They're also looking at adaptation, and they don't really have a choice because they're having a lot more inland flooding problems. When you get to the local level, the politics become secondary to the fact that if the street's flooding, you have to do something about it. So if we do get a president, heaven forbid, who says things like that, what will happen is it'll really shift the need for action to the local and state level even more than it already has been. And also it'll really put the onus on the private sector to move ahead. And again, when you're actually having to deal with these realities, you don't have the luxury of saying it's a hoax. So the insurance industry in Florida is not going to wait to be told by a member of Congress or by a recalcitrant president that they have to adjust to the fact that their investments are at risk in South Florida and other parts of that state.
That's Sharon Burke. She's the senior advisor for the International Security Program and Resource Security at New America. She's also former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy under the Obama administration. Sharon Burke, thank you.
My pleasure.
Also, thanks, retired Navy Admiral David Titley.
Thanks, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you today. There are over 15 million DNA profiles in the FBI's National DNA Index. They've been building it since 1998. And it won't surprise you to know that the FBI, even local police, collect DNA swabs when someone's arrested or suspected of a crime, just like fingerprints. But then imagine this, five teenagers sitting in a car in Melbourne, Florida. A cop pulls up to them, asks them what they're up to, and then asks which one of the boys wants to give a DNA sample. One of the boys consents, gives the cops his DNA. No crime's been committed. No crime is even suspected here. Now, the cops hold on to that DNA and store it in a private facility. And what you've just heard is a true story. You can find out about it at ProPublica. It's happening more and more in local police jurisdictions all over America, as police build local banks of DNA from people they arrest, but often from people they don't arrest. And that raises important questions, not just about who's regulating and setting rules for these databases, but also why are the police collecting information on people who aren't suspected of crimes? Frederick Heron is director of public safety of the Bensalem Police Department in Bensalem Township, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. His department started creating its own DNA database in 2010, and he joins me now. Fred, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me, Stephen Mercer, chief attorney for the Forensics Division of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender. He's been involved in state and federal cases about local DNA collection. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd.
So, Fred Heron, how do these locally collected databases actually work in your community?
What we're doing, we started in 2010, is when we have someone arrested for a crime or someone we suspect of a crime, we will ask them consensually for their DNA. We have about a 94% compliance rate where people give up their DNA. Why they do it, I don't know, but it's the same way. Why does someone give us consent to search the trunk of the car when they know they have 7 kilos of cocaine in the back? I don't know, but I've been in law enforcement for 30 years, and they've been doing it for 30 years. And unless the United States Supreme Court tells me to stop, I'm going to continue to do it.
All right, Stephen Mercer, how does this sound to you? Is this a lot of concern about DNA? And if we called it JFK, people would feel better about it? Or do you see a problem here?
There's a real concern. And here's why. As Mr. Heron was explaining, there is no set rule. It is in the hands of the officer on the street who's exercising discretion about who to collect DNA from. That level of discretion, without any guidance from regulations or protections or reporting requirements, what we see and what's been the experience of the public defender is that the usual suspects are targeted. And so we see this amplification of the biases in the criminal justice system along the lines of race being amplified through these types of unbridled collection program. And since the dawn of DNA databanks, if there's been one thing that there's been general agreement on is that given the vast potential for abuse of DNA and the profound privacy implications that are at stake, the close regulation and constitutional scrutiny of the government amassing the DNA of its citizenry is essential. And we're talking about DNA of innocent people here.
Fred Herron, Stephen Mercer is raising one of the key points here, which is the FBI database, which I mentioned at the top of our conversation, is, of course, governed by federal regulations. There are lots of rules about how that database is operated, chain of custody, and everything else. In your jurisdiction and many other states around the country, those regulations don't apply, and the rules are different everywhere you go.
Well, a couple of things here. He's a defense attorney, so of course he's going to take that stand, and I'm going to take my stand, and that's what makes this country great. And leave it to someone from Maryland to bring up a race issue. That is not the issue here. I don't know where we jump from DNA to race, but we do not have a disproportionate. I don't have those numbers, but I can certainly get it back to you. It is not primarily African-American or Hispanic database. That's just a ludicrous statement. But going back to what you were saying about the FBI, they have CODIS. Which is the federal database, what governs the three different databases, a local, a state, and NDIS, a national database. In Pennsylvania, if I was to submit DNA from a crime, from a property crime incident, I mean burglary, theft, it takes over 18 months to get those results. That's not acceptable. Right now, I'm doing it in less than 30 days. It takes sexual assault, rape, 7 months in Pennsylvania to process. I can get it back. I have a job right now. I'm getting the results back tomorrow. We submitted it 2 days ago. I'm getting the results back tomorrow. Plus, Bensdale Township, what you said is officers are out there on their own. We have strict rules and regulations regarding the collection of DNA. We are state certified. We are state accredited, and we are finishing our national CLIA accreditation, which we should get accredited in November. So it's not a rogue cop out there just like with a swab of a Q-tip collecting DNA.
So, Stephen Mercer, then before we go, can you just comment on my impression that I had when I started reading about this, that if the cops asked me for my DNA and I didn't have to give it, I would be nuts to say yes?
Well, yes, absolutely, because what you're not hearing about is the very real risk of misidentification that can occur in these local databanks, which are really, truly the repositories of junk DNA. These local databanks, which are unregulated, invite the junk from crime scenes that isn't allowed in a quality-controlled database at the state or national level. And so when you start creating these local databanks of innocent persons' DNA, and remember, Mr. Herron keeps talking about criminals. He's not talking in this local database are not compelled samples from those convicted, but these are people that Mr. Herron suspects will commit a crime, and so he wants their DNA for some future investigation.
All right. Fred, we got to go, so quickly your response.
I said in the beginning, these are all ASCLAD certified. They have the same compliance with the FBI quality assurance standards and forensic testing and DNA. They're not rogue labs. Junk DNA is an old term. All that is we're not looking to see if you have genetic disabilities and medical conditions. We're looking to identify you as an individual that have possibly committed that crime. It's not some lab that just opened up around the corner next to a bodega. That's a ridiculous assertion. And he knows better than that. And these labs we use are certified
point,
in
Fred,
Maryland.
Fred,
well,
I know Bode Labs. They are certified.
Guys,
this is not a question of a rogue lab. This is a question of a rogue databank. You can put in your databank what you can't put
it's
in
not
the
a rogue,
national databank. It absolutely is.
We have,
you cannot submit. Right. You can put right. into your forensic right. unknown index at the local right. level samples that you cannot put in the national level, and you know that, and don't deny it.
You're comparing apples to oranges now. And
no,
the other
I'm
thing
not.
That we didn't talk about
I'm
is
right
we don't use the DNA as the get-all. We also, after we bring these people in, they confess to the crime. It's just a pointer for us. It's not the end-all where we go and put handcuffs after we get the DNA results back. But this is not a 10-minute conversation. That's the problem.
Okay.
Well, no, you're right about that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you can hear some of the controversy that's embedded in the collection of DNA. Fred Herron, Director of Public Safety of the Ben Salem Police Department in Pennsylvania. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Mercer, Chief Attorney for the Forensics Division of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
And you can find a longer version of this discussion over at the website at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. When the city of Detroit emerged from the nation's largest ever municipal bankruptcy almost 2 years ago, it was left with a razor-thin financial cushion. Now, Detroit's downtown is booming with new construction everywhere, but some longtime residents, primarily African Americans, fear that all of that investment is not about them. It's geared to attract upscale white millennials to the city. And now, Detroit officials are weighing how much of the city's scant resources they should be spending for this city's outlying, mostly abandoned neighborhoods. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
Detroit is huge, 139 square miles. At its height in the 1950s, the Motor City had almost 2 million residents. Now, after decades of lost manufacturing jobs and at times outright public corruption, Detroit has a population of less than 700,000. One of the most desolate and dangerous neighborhoods is called Brightmoor.
And then we're going to the park to go to the party, okay?
Yet on the front porch of a modest single-family home, Dawn Wilson Clark sits in a pocket of hope, one of hundreds of homes built about a decade and a half ago to push back against the overwhelming blight.
And actually, my ex-husband was not happy about this location. I told him, don't worry about it. They're going to tear that house down. They're going to tear these houses down. And in 10 years, the neighborhood's going to be different. And we're going to be a part of that. He didn't agree, and he's gone, and I'm still here with a wonderful new husband who is helping me be a part of the change.
Dawn says she has to drive her children miles away from Brightmoor so they can attend decent schools. But she also says her kids have had positive entrepreneurial and artistic experiences in Brightmoor she doubts would happen anywhere else in the city. She wonders if Detroit officials will consider that when they determine how much service to provide to the mostly decayed area.
I just hope residents are at the table when those decisions are being made. We have endured the blight, the turmoil, the gunshots, the crime, but we've stayed in our communities because we want it to be there. We need to have a voice.
City officials say that message has been received.
All these neighborhoods have a future. They don't all have the same future.
Maurice Cox is Detroit's chief city planner. He came here after helping guide the rebuilding of flood-ravaged New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. But Cox says in many ways the situation in Detroit is worse.
One of the challenges that Detroit has is because it's so large, whenever you invest in the public realm, you can barely see it because often it's spread so thinly. And where investors see the public resources, they tend to gravitate.
Yet Cox says the mostly vacant outskirts offer a unique opportunity.
We can go in and green 20 acres. Like, how many neighborhoods in America can you go in and do that? And then actually employ people from that neighborhood as a part of the green collar workforce. And then on the flip side, you know, we have probably the largest inventory of historic structures that are available for reuse in the country.
Cox vows that Detroit will continue providing water, electricity, and police protection to all neighborhoods, even those that are desolate. But he predicts that will become increasingly unnecessary as rebuilding continues in Detroit communities that are beginning to thrive.
So if you have a chance to live in a neighborhood where you can walk within 20 minutes of your house to grocery, fresh produce, greenways, quality schools, or you can live in an area where you don't have many neighbors anymore, the services are inadequate. You know, where would people rather live?
Some folks in Detroit, which remains mired in high rates of poverty and unemployment, don't have the luxury or the financial ability to move to more choice neighborhoods. Experts say those people won't have to move if their current communities can be repurposed.
This one over here. It's not just planting flowers, but these actually have environmental attributes to them.
At a kind of think tank called Detroit Future City, Executive Director Annika Goss Foster points to a map of projects she says are flourishing in impoverished neighborhoods that are proving unexpectedly resilient.
The view of the city was very black and white. The city's too big, so we need to shut it down, right? I think now we're viewing those communities very differently. Let's think about how we might use vacant land for a solar array to reduce energy efficiency. You need large acreage for that. Let's think about the land for community farming.
In fact, some researchers view that barely occupied land as a living laboratory for testing urban revitalization. Even pieces of wood left over from homes that have been demolished are sometimes reused as a part of a new home. Miles away, in some ways worlds away, from those neighborhoods, Detroit's downtown is humming with construction work, a huge sports arena complex, a commuter rail line. For a motor city that touts itself as having put the world on wheels, Detroit has almost no public transportation. City officials are trying to bridge a decades-old battle with their suburban counterparts and create a regional transit authority. But all of that seems very far away back in Brightmoor. On her front porch, surrounded by her children, Dawn Wilson Clark wonders if they or her neighborhood truly have a place in Motown's future.
You need to realize that people matter, not just the big business and not just people coming in, moving into this new fancy hip Detroit. You need to take care of the people who've been taking care of the city.
Detroit officials say they meet often with community leaders as they decipher where best to use the city's financial resources. But they add that they must increase Detroit's tax base if they hope to afford the way forward. And that means attracting new residents who, officials say, will in all likelihood want to move to a city with a vibrant urban atmosphere, not neighborhoods filled with the debris of the past. For The Takeaway, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. So can the Internal Revenue Service function like Facebook, HUD like Amazon? Megan Smith thinks the answer is yes. Smith is the United States Chief Technology Officer and Assistant to the President at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And she wants to set a new expectation. No more paper, no more stamps and floppy disks. Bureaucracy, she says, can and should not only survive, but thrive in the digital world. Over the next few weeks, we're teaming up with our partners at PRI and WGBH's Innovation Hub show to explore some of the most pressing innovation challenges that will face our next president. John Hockenberry sat down with Megan Smith recently, and for her, it's about getting everyone in America on board with new technology, not just the startup artists in Silicon Valley.
It really is the beginning of digital government. And this president, you know, President Obama welcomed us from the beginning. I'm the third person in the CTO job, but really creating the chief technology officer job in the Office of Science Technology Policy to really drive, like our role is help the president and his team harness the power of data, innovation, and technology on behalf of the American people. Of course, the government has always been using data and technology and innovation at various points. I mean, President Washington started the Army Corps of Engineers as part of the Continental Army. So it's been amazing to work with this extraordinary group of people who serve in government and bring more of the techies in with the leadership of the president pulling us to serve in a tour of duty and really bring these capabilities on the challenges that government faces so we can better serve the American people.
This idea of digital government is fundamental and very, very different. And it's not about jobs at all. It's about changing really the way citizenship works. What does that mean?
Yeah, so the president went to South by Southwest last spring really to engage the tech innovation community and pull people for tours of duty and to also just work on these harder problems together. You know, we have the internet for the first time. Not all Americans have it, and we have a lot of policies and work like Connect Ed and Connect Home, Connect All, Broadband Opportunity Council, a lot of work to bring that all the way through, as well as spectrum work to increase speeds. But really, how do we get all the Americans in on the kind of innovation prosperity? And how do we deliver services in the way that, you know, we see Amazon, Facebook, Google, Twitter, these extraordinary American companies? We should do that, you know, from the IRS, from HUD, from Department of Education. And a big part of that actually is using open data and open government and transparency. President's opened over 200,000 data sets. So an example would be early on, people like NOAA opened the weather data, or the U.S. Geological Survey opened up mapping data. Can we do that across all of the agencies? So with the open data sets and engagement, Census team, for example, has put together a software developer kit, the software developer kit you might get for Android or iPhone to make apps, a software developer kit for cities. And so all the different APIs or data sets that would be useful for doing transportation or education, housing, preschool, schools, diversity work, et cetera, to include everyone. Those are sets of data available for developers and other extraordinary people to get in and kind of create value on top of that and solve problems in whole new ways. One of my favorite ones in that area is around justice and the Police Data Initiative and data-driven justice to really help us solve these problems that we have to make life fairer and better for all Americans.
Now, how do you use digital technology to give people a different sense of justice? I mean, I will just say that the app that has most transformed my relationship with a government agency is the app that tells me when the buses are coming. And the, you know, MTA in New York, long an evil institution, is now just this benign helper just because I have access to this kind of information. How can you do that with justice?
Exactly. So there's so many different data sets around that can help us be better informed. So an example here in the area of sort of transparency, we saw that Dallas and Los Angeles and a bunch of other cities were actually releasing use of force data, officer violence, shooting, all kinds of data sets, and engaging with the community around what was happening and starting to solve problems in new ways. So we were able to put together the Police Data Initiative that allows lots of different jurisdictions to now collaborate with each other. And there's more than 50 jurisdictions now interacting with each other and releasing data. There's also, we noticed, just solutions within the enterprise of the local city. So similar to your bus example, police forces together with the health services and homeless services, other services in a couple cities have really collaborated on their internal data. They're not releasing this publicly, so it's different from the Police Data Initiative. It's called data-driven justice. And this would be an example where we found that Miami, for example, had 7,000 prisoners and had dropped to 4,900 prisoners just by changing how they were interacting with people, where the police could take folks. Let's say somebody has mental health issues or they have substance abuse disorder. The option for the police was to take people to jail or to the emergency room. They created instead a stabilization unit in the hospital with 12 beds, and they started to take people. They trained 911, police officers, and others. And of 50,000 calls across 4 years that matched this, they only had 109 arrests, and people were able to get better. So that helped them reduce the prison population, have much better outcomes for families, for individuals, as well as a lot of cost saving.
Is this an irreversible process? In other words, what of this kind of initiative and these programs that you've talked about can be just wiped away and reversed by a different occupant of the White House who doesn't have the kinds of interest and sensibilities that President Obama has? How much of this is permanent?
You know, I think it's permanent, sort of the way that we interact with our smartphones and the way we're interacting with companies at this point. People have the expectation that government will work that way, and we're starting to see that. President Obama, of course, has welcomed us as techies into government in these tours. And, you know, if the techies could have solved this on their own, they wouldn't. It's through the collaboration, almost like a university faculty, of extraordinary economists, lawyers, you know, operators together with tech, sitting together at the policy and the implementation or capacity building table to come up with how do we use these new methods, these new digital government, data-driven, you know, collaboration, open source. We just launched the open source policy for the U.S. We're not experiencing it as a partisan thing. We've been welcomed by everyone. It's kind of practice makes permanent. In this case, as we learn how to ride this bicycle, we're getting better and better at it. So we're pretty excited about what is happening. Most of government's going to tech and government's going to be from our contractors and our incredible private sector. And so how are we upgrading how we're working together?
Megan Smith is the U.S. Chief Technology Officer based at the White House. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thanks, John.
John Hockenberry there speaking with Megan Smith, part of a collaboration with our partners at PRI and WGBH's Innovation Hub show. And here's something to take with you today. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio tried to bring the city's phone booths into the 21st century by converting them into free Wi-Fi kiosks. You're supposed to be able to, you know, check the weather, subway directions, and then a reminder of everything the internet has to offer. Following complaints that users were camping out around those kiosks, watching porn and streaming movies for several hours at a time, the kiosk's internet browsers have now been disabled until the city can come up with a new plan. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day. At curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.